Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT. Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So, Brandon, how do you evaluate or grade the final promo? Closing out Dynamite, a rare situation where Dynamite ends with a promo. MJF talking about defending his world title and everything going on around him. And then Jay White coming out and saying he will beat MJF in so many words, in Jay White style and cadence. And then having his guys attack MJF from behind. And then Jay White enters the ring, hits a Blade Runner, and emphasizes as the show closes a visual three count of what it could be. He covered him, and Juice counted to three. MJF did not kick out. Did you like this as a final hype for the pay-per-view on Saturday?
I did, and I came into the night overall a little down on this main event, because for as much as I sort of criticized AEW for booking Jay White the way that they did when he first signed with the company, I thought that though they got him to the spot on the card where I thought he belonged, that they had been doing overall a pretty poor job at making him seem like a credible main event challenger to MJF. And I say that acknowledging, of course, that he stole the championship and has been running around with it for several weeks. But to me, the association with the Guns and with Juice Robinson in particular, the way that that group, the way that Bullet Club Gold as a whole carries itself, feels decidedly well below the main event to me. And so by proxy, Jay White was kind of pulled down with his cohorts. I thought that tonight, having him at first come out there on his own, cut a real serious promo, and say, you know, what needed to be said to MJF following what I thought was a really strong promo from Max as well, was a good way to press the reset button and to refocus this as a really important one-on-one championship match, which is something that I feel like they had gotten away from a little too much in the last several weeks of build, be it with the involvement of the rest of Bullet Club Gold and everything else going on with Max peripherally.
Yeah, I think that's been the sort of the sense that I have, that there's so much going on with MJF, good and bad. I mean, it's good that there's all these people who want his title and are aiming for his title, and, you know, Wardlow and Samoa Joe, and then stuff going on with Roderick Strong and company, and Hobbs was even in that mix for a little while, and obviously Jay White. I might be missing somebody as I recite all these names. That's good. MJF's character's been all over the place, though. And part of it is, you know, this having to divert from their original plans because of the Cole injury and having to kind of regroup and reshuffle and find a new lane to drive in going to a major pay-per-view. And I thought this was just really solid. It was simplified and, you know, kind of stripped down to, for better or for worse, MJF being MJF's in character saying he wants to prove to the fans he's changed. Mm-hmm. And admitting he's scared, that he feels vulnerable about how he wanted to be on the top of the mountain and he's scared for that to come to an end. And so he's a vulnerable, scared, lead babyface champion showing you know, not desperation, but yeah, fear that things could come to an end. But then also expressing, you know, confidence that it won't happen, that he'll bring the fight to stay on top of the mountain. So, you know, basically it was just 101. I want to be champion. I like being on top. Come get me. I won't go down easy. And I mean, that's fine. Like that's tried and true. And I thought MJF did a good job delivering that. We can argue about whether he should, you know, the judgment call to have him say he's scared. But I think people can relate to what he's saying, you know, that's his lifelong goal. And then Jay White's just Jay White. You know, to me, I'm a fan of the Guns and Juice as his sidekicks. They've grown on me. I am not I'm not able to out of hand dismiss the impression that you expressed and many others have, that it does seem like he's surrounded by people who don't live up to the image of the Bullet Club in terms of the top secondary people in the group. You know, that they, I mean, the Guns are really talented, but from a standpoint of being serious people, Colton sort of is, but obviously Austin and Juice aren't. So it's, you know, it's tough because does that pull Jay White down, or is Jay White able to stand there like he did on the stage with the rhythm of his talking and just sell people on the match? And I thought he did a really good job. I'm still, you know, as a sidebar, annoyed that he's carrying around a title belt, which could have easily been resolved by management saying you're suspended till the end of 2023 and you don't get a world title shot unless you get the belt back, which was a threat that they made to keep Hangman and Swerve from touching each other. But that aside, still a, I thought a good 1-2-3 punch. Punch one, MJF's babyface champion promo. Punch two, Jay White with his cadence and confidence, with his command of words and in the microphone, and then punch three being the beatdown in the visual of MJF losing. So yeah, I give it a thumbs up. They kept it basic and straightforward. I thought it was good for MJF to discuss the devil and all the other people coming at him, because I think you want to plant in the minds of fans that something could go wrong for MJF having to do with these other forces, as opposed to Jay White and Bullet Club Gold beating him. So you want that to be floating out there if you think it's a selling point, and they obviously do.
Yeah, for me with Bullet Club Gold, it's less about the Guns and Juice as talent. It's more about the demeanor, the presentation, the way that they carry themselves. It screams mid-card to me. Especially Juice. I mean the over the top promo and the screaming and the just everything about Juice to me is decidedly mid-card. So it's hard for me to just fully get behind the group as a whole. I think if he toned that down a little bit and they felt less like hapless lackeys that I'm seeing too much of, and more just like, you know, these people that Jay can use at his disposal and his advantage, much like he did tonight. Like, that didn't bother me at all. You know, the run-in from the Guns and from Juice to beat down MJF, to do Jay White's bidding. But the second that they're on the microphone or featured prominently, especially with the cardboard cutout of Jay White, there's something about it that just irks me.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Do you think you have an idea of what the finish is going to be Saturday night at Full Gear in this main event match?
I really don't, and I sort of like it that way.
I mean,
part of me thinks, you know, they're not going to go with Jay White after giving him the visual victory tonight, the visual finish over MJF. The other thing that I think is sort of working against the idea of Jay White leaving with the title is the fact that he's been carrying around that title for weeks on end. I mean, seeing a wrestler hold a championship for the first time is a really important piece of a successful title run. And I think they've really done a disservice to White by having him have that title. You know, it's one thing to beat down a wrestler in the ring, pick up his title and hold it, you know,
right.
Say, I'm going to take this. But to actually be carrying it around for weeks on end as though he is the champion fans get used to that. And so the sight of Jay White carrying around the actual AEW title, if he were to win, will not be fresh. It won't feel new or exciting because he's already had it for several weeks now. So I'm inclined to think that MJF is more likely to retain, but I can't rule out the fact that there's just a ton of shenanigans that are plausible with, like you already mentioned, challengers from all angles. You have Wardlow, you have Samoa Joe, you have the Devil and whoever the Devil's cronies are. There's a lot of possibilities that come into play that would mean Jay White either wins the championship underneath nefarious means or MJF is retaining the title, but there is a significant launching point to another major story.
There's like, I would not want to see every NHL team skate around at the Stanley Cup for like 2 weeks of the year as a preview of what might happen in June or whatever the Stanley Cup ends these days. Like, there is something about that moment of seeing a wrestler with the championship belt that feels, I don't know, not to be corny about it, but sort of sacred. Like, you shouldn't get to walk around with a belt unless you've been booked to earn it. And there is something to that. And it takes something away from, I'm with you, that, and I've thought this, it takes something away from Jay White possibly winning it someday because he's already walked around with that belt. That image is there, and it's been there a lot. And to me, it almost gives away he's not winning. You know, I mean, it's just like you would not want that. He wouldn't want him to have the title if he was really going to – the belt, if he was really going to win it. So I just am not a fan of the angle, and I just don't think there's a way. I don't know that they thought it through. I mean, how do you sell it? Like, what's the hook? What's the – are people supposed to be angry? Mm-hmm. Like, what's he doing with the title? Well, they don't really sell the idea that it's a disgrace that Jay White is walking around with something he didn't earn. If they went all in on that and said, this is disgraceful, then they have the problem. Well, why doesn't Tony Khan do something about it? So it's just an angle you can't really pull off because the bigger deal you make out of it, the more absurd it seems. So I just would say, and I think it's safe to say now because this was pretty much the go-home show, it was a mistake to do it for the reasons we said and other reasons. So that's a bummer. But I do think it makes it seem less likely Jay White wins the title, which is probably one of the worst aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Yep. All right, well, let's pause and just introduce ourselves here and then get on to a conversation about other aspects of the show. And also we'll look at the Full Gear lineup and also what they announced for Collision Rampage, which will be going head-to-head with SmackDown on Friday because they don't want to go head-to-head with Full Gear, understandably. Mm-hmm. So, although they could announce, like, five really boring matches or like two, you could do like an Iron Man match. And I'm trying to think who deserves to be picked on. I don't know. I Peter Avalon doesn't, but he comes to mind, like an Iron Man match, Peter Avalon against Brandon Cutler in a 60-minute Iron Man match. Just tank the show. So you can plug All In and go, well, if you don't like this match, you can order All In. I'm sorry. Full Gear and watch it live instead of this pre-taped boring match. But anyway, this is Wade Keller, Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, November 15th, 2023. I'm Wade Keller, host of the show, the editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly Newsletter, documenting professional wrestling contemporaneously since the late 1980s. And also, pwtorch.com, our main website, covered with news and commentary and flashbacks and cool features every single day. Hope you're checking it out. And then also, I host various podcasts, including VIP exclusive shows like The Fix with Todd Martin, which will go up tomorrow night, everything with Rich and Wade, which went up, which we recorded yesterday and has since gone up, and Wade Keller Hotlines, and post pay-per-view roundtables, which we'll be doing Saturday after Full Gear, for instance, and more. I also host free shows like this, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. You can search Wade Keller on your podcast app. Subscribe for free to both this, the Red Logo Show, the post shows, and our Blue Logo Show, our main podcast, which included my podcast with Jason from ProWrestling.net and the Pro Wrestling Boom Podcast yesterday. 2 hours of conversation, preview of Full Gear, WWE talk, and much more. And then VIP members got nearly a one-hour VIP exclusive after show with Jason and me answering email questions and hitting some other topics. To be a VIP member, you just have to go to pwtorch.com/govip. Multiple price points and different benefit packages through Patreon. Also, you can subscribe directly with your Apple account on your iPhone using the Apple Podcast account, Or you can sign up and get access to our library and go through our main ad-free VIP website and sign up with credit card, debit card, or PayPal. All those options are explained at pwtorch.com/govip. One of the VIP perks is you get to hear the post shows and the podcast, the shows that are free, along with the daily casts without the commercial break interruptions, the pre-recorded ads that get dropped in on the free feed. So that's a nice perk also. pwtorch.com/govip. All right. The other voice you hear is Brandon LeClaire from PW Torch. He contributes pay-per-view reports and co-hosts various post shows. Brandon, it is – and sometimes joins us on the post-pay-per-view roundtables. Brandon, welcome back to the co-host chair.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here. It's certainly timely given that we have Full Gear this weekend and then Survivor Series the following weekend.
Absolutely. So if you want to join us in conversation, the number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. We're a little bit late getting started. We had some issues with the switchboard. I think it got reset. So some of you are finding us here, and you are welcome to push one and join the conversation with your thoughts either on tonight's Dynamite or Full Gear. In some cases, they overlap. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. We are here every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday night with live post-show coverage. You can live stream the show. The link is at pwtorch.com in my TV report at the top and bottom. You can also find us at wadekellerpostshow.com and navigate to the live feed. We start about 5 minutes or so after Raw, Dynamite, SmackDown, and Collision each week. The number again, 347-215-8558. And when you call, push one. Brandon, overall, I want to step back and just ask for your thoughts on the hype for Full Gear overall. Did they do a good job selling the full pay-per-view lineup? To me, they covered a couple matches well and didn't do a lot for most of them. There's Adam Copeland, for instance, is on pay-per-view on Saturday. Did they mention his name tonight?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, he's in a six-man tag with Sting. Sting's having one of his final matches ever, right? He's retiring in a few months. Did they mention that? It's weird.
It feels like they've sort of been the collision act for the last couple of weeks. It seems like they're sort of. I know that Adam Copeland said that he was going to be there every week, and I guess that's true, but it certainly seems like he's kind of picking up the collision slack where CM Punk left off.
Yes, that is a fact, but it does not justify the fact that they didn't mention it tonight.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I know you're not saying that at all, but I mean, like, they're going to go head-to-head with SmackDown on Friday, and that's when they're going to hype mm-hmm. Adam Copeland and mm-hmm. Sting and Darby against Christian and his crew. It's weird.
I'm looking through the card right now. We got just a little bit as far as the women's world title match. I wouldn't really call what we got from Tony much of hype. As you mentioned, nothing for the Adam Copeland Christian Cage match. Got a bit for Cassidy and Jon Moxley. Certainly got plenty for Hangman Adam Page and Swerve Strickland. Golden Jets Young Bucks match got some hype. The triple threat for the three way for the TBS championship doesn't really have anything. It was just sort of setting up the match. Nothing really of note for the world tag title match. And then of course MJF and Jay White. So yeah, I mean, maybe about half the card, and then they'll pick up the second half on Collision. I didn't feel like they had done a great job building the card, and that's typically how I feel about most AEW pay-per-views. I mean, I've said many times on these post shows before that to me they tend to book pay-per-views too late, and though the shows always deliver typically in big fashion, I would much prefer that they announce more matches further ahead of time and try to put a little bit more into them rather than focusing so heavily on the TV product. But most of this card was announced well enough in advance, and I think they did an okay job with what they did hype tonight.
But yeah, I mean, you'd always like to see a little bit more. And there are elements of this card that I'm not in love with. The Golden Jets, for example, and the Young Bucks match, and then the four way for the tag team championships, the three way for the TBS title. They just sort of seem thrown together.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we got hype for the Golden Jets, Kenny Omega and Chris Jericho against the Young Bucks. I want to get your thoughts on that segment because I've been calling for more screen time and talking time for the Bucks and Kenny. Mm-hmm. Did this build my case or did this show why they maybe are better off just doing moves in the ring? I say that with trying not to show my hand because
I thought that the limited mic time that the Bucks had tonight further cemented my belief that they need to be heels. I think that this is the time to go all in. The tide is clearly turning with them. I mean, the commentary made mention of the fact tonight that they were in their hometown and they were getting booed. And I think that goes beyond just getting, you know, hitting low blows on Penta Commander.
Commander, yeah.
I think that there is definitely some negative inertia working there coming out of the CM Punk drama, stuff that's been going on recently. I mean, the comment this week on Instagram about, you know, the alternative was being left off the card, and a lot of people were basically like, I'd kind of prefer that. There's just a lot of negativity surrounding the Bucks right now, and if they play their cards right, they could potentially turn that negativity into a positive run as a heel team. But I just sense that there's a lot of fatigue with them right now. And I part of the reason I don't like this match is first, because it does feel very thrown together. I mean, Kenny Omega is in the middle of this blood feud with the Don Callis family, and suddenly they're just going to take a night off to wrestle the Young Bucks in a match that seems pretty meaningless overall. I mean, if you're Kenny Omega, you should be a lot more worried about the Don Callis family than you are about the Young Bucks being upset that you're teaming with Chris Jericho. So that's one thing. But the other reason is just because I think Kenny Omega is so much more effective when he's away from the Young Bucks. I just don't want to see them together, be that, you know, teaming as the Elite or opposite each other. I would rather they just be in their own separate, not universes, but in their own portions of the show separated, because I think much like my feelings about the Gun Club and Juice Robinson dragging my opinion of Jay White down, I think I hold the same opinion about the Bucks and Kenny.
Yeah, I joked last week, you know, they really broke out of their comfort zone doing a match in a segment, the Bucks with Kenny. And I agree. I mean, I'd really like to see them against other people. It does feel thrown together. And, I mean, you would think if you're building a feud that involves the Don Callis family, you would want to have a good excuse to not have a match with Kenny against the Don Callis family.
Mm-hmm.
What are the Don Callis family doing on Full Gear?
They're not.
Yeah. How is that even possible?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
How does that happen?
I know.
So I agree with you on the Bucks being better off heels. And I try not to show my hand. I like the segment tonight. I have my issues with this match like you do. I mean, there's a little bit of a story to it. It just feels sort of dropped in mm-hmm. as this it's inserted in the midst of something that maybe should be that this didn't have to happen now because there's something better that they were building up.
It feels like this should have been the Dynamite match, and then Omega and Jericho should have something with the Callis family on the pay-per-view.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm with you on the Bucks being heels, and I want them to channel whatever frustrations they have with the fans or whatever their emotions are that some people are reading into. That caused them to have some, you know, animosity towards them. Like, figure out how to turn that into money.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see the Bucks be on TV every week, acting cocky and agitating the fans and being a thorn in the side of Tony Khan, or ideally wrestling with babyface tag team opponents at the top of the tag team division, having good tag matches and cutting good promos and being obnoxious. I think they can be good at that. We've seen them be good at that. It's not, you don't even have to theorize. So I would like that. And yeah, I mean, I'm eager for Kenny to move on to something else. By the way, they posted Kota Ibushi is All Elite. Tony Khan said it is now official that he is All Elite. So Ibushi signed to AEW. So we'll see more with Kenny and Kota given that news. Your reaction to that, Brandon?
He didn't deserve his own major announcement on TV or pay-per-view.
Well, I don't know if that's how they normally announce signings. It just sort of, yeah, the way they announce big signings is the wrestler sort of appears now and then eventually they sign them. Yeah.
Yeah. That's just more of a crack at, hey, we're doing this again on Saturday. Please watch.
Yeah. Yep. Also we had the tease by Tony Khan, which got mentioned on TV tonight, that he's signed a wrestler respected by all AEW fans. What the quote was familiar today by Tony Khan on Twitter X, AEW has agreed to terms with one of the world's best wrestlers, a pro who is known and respected by virtually every AEW fan. They'll come to LA to sign their contract this Saturday on pay-per-view. So a really good hook for the pay-per-view. You know, you're basically saying there's going to be news on Saturday. And the use of the gender neutral they keeps things open to it being a male or female wrestler. Brandon, what name or names come to mind when that news broke or when it got mentioned on TV tonight?
Well, the first two that come to mind are Mercedes Moné and Will Ospreay. I mean, those are the two that immediately sprang to mind, and you know, obviously the general consensus on social media appeared to be the same. There's been some conjecture about whether or not Ospreay is technically a free agent or will be, I guess, in January. But if AEW does have a working relationship with New Japan, I suppose they could perhaps get around that. Mercedes as well, it seems like she's not going to be ready to wrestle until 2024. I don't know if she is currently under contract with any of the promotions that she's worked for in Japan. So I guess it's just a matter, you know, semantics in terms of what does it mean by free agent? Are they truly a free agent at the moment, or are they becoming a free agent? If it's not one of those two, this is going to feel like another massive letdown. I mean, if you run the you run the gambit of possible names, and I just don't know who else there is that is going to strike that kind of reaction among fans. And really, I don't even know what either of them do to move the needle in terms of announcements, because I mean, this has become a boy who cried wolf situation. The announcements are fine. They're typically, you know, decent announcements or even good to great announcements, but so often they amount to so very little. I mean, Adam Copeland felt like a huge signing and a huge debut and a huge deal. And to me, he already feels like just a part of the show. I mean, there's nothing about
yesterday's news and flat and relegated to Collision.
Yeah. I mean, it just doesn't feel like anything significant. And Will Ospreay being in AEW full time is great, but he's been there a bunch. We've kind of been there, done that. We know what he brings to the table. He's clearly one of the best in the world, but AEW has a lot of the best in the world, and not all of them get featured the way that you want them to. So Ospreay, I don't see how he moves the needle in any significant way. With Mercedes Moné, I can no longer confidently say it feels like for a long time I gave AEW the benefit of the doubt, and every time they would bring in a big female free agent signing, I would say, all right, this is the wrestler who's going to turn the tide for the AEW women's division. Strap the rocket to her back, give her the title out of the gate, and let's rebuild this division from the ground up, you know, around so-and-so, free agent X.
And time and time and time and time and time again, it just never goes anywhere. And there are things about the women's division in AEW that I think are good. I point to positives with Toni Storm's current character, positives with Julia Hart's run right now, the undercurrent of support that has built for Willow Nightingale, though I don't think AEW has done a good job of capitalizing on that. I don't think that Mercedes Moné changes anything because Tony Khan has shown an inability to book a compelling women's division long-term. And I don't think that a character as talented as Mercedes is going to fix that.
I think that the former Sasha Banks would be the best shot that they have to send a signal to fans. We've got a true established main event, top tier female act that the women wrestlers who you become familiar with, from Toni Storm to Willow Nightingale to Chris Statlander to Hikaru Shida, they're going to be fresh matchups, and they're going to be near the main event of whatever show or pay-per-view they appear on because she's such a big name. The problem is people lose steam when they go to AEW. People lose steam. CM Punk was sort of like this larger-than-life exception, but I mean, Adam Cole has lost steam, wasn't booked great out of the gate. The situation with Bryan Danielson has been kind of weird. It's more like him just kind of, you know, having dream matches as opposed to integrating himself fully into the ways that I think would better help AEW grow. But if that was the terms of him going there, it is what it is. I mean, I'm not going to like blame Tony for that. I think he tried to make Saraya a star, but you know, she was going to be limited, in terms of her, you know, durability or her schedule or whatever. I don't know. And some people are fine. You know, Malachi Black, Miro, they just sort of spin their wheels year after year. It's not like bad, but AEW doesn't elevate them into more. And I do worry a little bit that if Mercedes Moné came in and is the signing, that the shine would be gone pretty quick. And she would just end up being another wrestler in the mix like Adam Copeland has been. Now, if she really brought it, if she had a chip on her shoulder about what happened in WWE and she showed, you know, this like leadership and maturity and kind of just grabbed the reins and said, let's make this division great and got Tony excited. And because I don't think there's anything that makes it harder to book women than men, other than you generally have a smaller group of established stars to work with. And that's not nothing. But if you had Sasha Banks, Mercedes Moné, you should have enough to work with the rest of your roster. So I would be intrigued by that. I think Will Ospreay fits the definition better. But, you know, he's somebody who's been around. And so it's kind of like what we say with Jay White holding a belt to take some of the fun away from him winning. Will Ospreay's sort of been around. So if the signing is Will Ospreay, it's like a lot of people who aren't on social media, aren't tracking the exact month, the date of free agents and all that are going to be like, well, isn't he already in AEW? Like, isn't he already somebody who's been here? So, you know, people are going to want, you know, it to be somebody brand new who hasn't appeared in AEW. And that's where Sasha Banks, I think, would be more crowd-pleasing.
Yeah, I think that from purely an announcement standpoint, there's no question that Mercedes is a far bigger deal than Will Ospreay overall. I think the other really interesting situation to me with Moné is she has been vocal and critical of her booking in the past. And she is someone who takes her work very seriously and takes the way that she's presented very seriously. And we saw that led to her leaving her dream gig. I mean, WWE was her dream gig. And if you're a women's wrestler and you want to work for a major United States promotion, there's no question that WWE is still the place that you want to be. AEW's women's division has never, ever shown the ability to live up to where the women have landed in WWE. And hopefully that changes one day. And maybe Mercedes thinks that she can be the catalyst to that happening. But if she isn't, and this is a situation where she comes in and, you know, the bloom is off the rose within a month or so, give or take, and she is just in a random feud fighting for 10 minutes of TV time on Dynamite every other week, then you're going to have another CM Punk situation on your hands.
Yeah. And that's not that you just don't want, you're right. She is a candidate to be that type of person. And so if Tony Khan is signing her, I mean, you really want to set up the parameters for, of what the expectations are for all parties involved to keep them.
You want to make sure that if it's going to fail, it's going to be because of her, not because of the company.
Yeah. Just because it turns out, even when you do things right, she's unreasonable and unmanageable. And, you know, I mean, if that's, you want that to be, if you take a chance on that and it doesn't work out, that's better than you did things wrong and blew up what could have been a good thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Okay. So we talked about the matches that were hyped. At the top of the show, we had Hook and Orange Cassidy against John Moxley and Wheeler Yuta, which helped set up or add some steam to Orange Cassidy against John Moxley for the international title. We had Mox addressing him after the match, and he said that he's nothing and has never been something, and it's time for a course correction. He's going to grind him into dust, and Cassidy was sitting back looking concerned. The missing element was the title. I felt like that should have been a bigger topic of conversation when it comes to this match, because that's what kind of brings them together to cross paths on this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was sort of it felt like Moxley was cutting a promo against a big time heel, and so it sort of felt off in that regard.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue. Yeah,
because Cassidy is such a babyface, and I mean, really, this is a match between two babyfaces. That's been one of my biggest issues with the Blackpool Combat Club and Moxley especially, is that they're just rarely ever defined. I mean, they're heels, but people still like them, and then, like, they start wrestling heels, so now I guess they're babyfaces, but Bryan Danielson's always a babyface because people just can't help but love him, so even when he's vicious and kicking people's faces in, you're still going to cheer him. So then, like, if he's a babyface, does it make the rest of the group a babyface? It's just a mess, and it's been a mess for a long time. I guess I would categorize them at babyfaces at this point. I don't think it's out of line to say that, which means this is a face versus face match, and yet they're kind of treating it with a much different tone. I like the demeanor of Orange Cassidy. I like the fact that John Moxley, and in particular the International Championship, brings out a seriousness in Cassidy, and he was obsessed with getting that championship back, and he was aloof and even more so than usual, and unable to engage with his friends because all he could think about was getting back that title. And once he got it back, there was a bit of a return to the old Orange Cassidy, but then John Moxley showed up and hinted that he wants to take that title back. And ever since then, Cassidy has been kind of falling back into that more serious, sinister role where you can tell that he wants to defeat John Moxley, that in order to solidify his championship run, this second international championship run, he has to beat Moxley. And I like that. I like all of the implications of that. I just think that the way they've approached Moxley's promo work against Cassidy has been a little counterproductive for the positions that they're both in.
I want Moxley, I say this all the time, Moxley, Danielson, Yuta, Claudio, I want them to just be aiming their charisma and all the traits that fans love about them and their vitriol at heels, so fans can mm-hmm. cheer them. And, you know, even in this match, it was like fans felt torn. They were cheering for the fight, but they weren't cheering mm-hmm. for someone to win. And I just think it's a lot more fun to cheer for someone to win as you're enjoying a fight than just cheering for the fight itself. By the way, what do you think of, it's a little less pertinent at the moment going into the pay-per-view, but what do you think of how Hook is coming along? What do you think of the last 2 years that he's had since he was all the rage and getting crazy crowd responses and come out after shows with Tony Khan and crowds are chanting for him? Do you think it was looking at his work in the ring now, it was good to kind of take it slow, let him get better? Because I thought this was one of his better performances in the ring. But it's still, every time I see him, it's like there was magic there that if somebody had just started watching Dynamite this year, they'd have no idea, like, what was once going on with him. And, you know, the old strike while the iron is hot, it's just, you know, warm right now.
Yeah, I think that obviously things have cooled off for him, which is, as we've kind of alluded to here during this show, the case for a lot of acts in AEW. They get hot and they have a really hard time staying hot. There's a lot of stifled momentum long term, and Hook is no stranger to that. I think that they protected him well in the early going, and that's, of course, when he was at his most over. Since then, it's been a bit of a mixed bag. I look back at, like, the summer, for example, when he was in that feud with Jack Perry, and I thought that they did, at times, a really good job, and at times, a not-so-great job at presenting him and putting him in an advantageous position to succeed. I don't mind the pairing with him and Orange Cassidy. I think it's a little bit it works better when Cassidy is in this more serious position versus the Cassidy we see with Best Friends, because I think that Hook, while it's good to display some level of personality, I think it's much better if, generally speaking, you're taking him overall pretty seriously. I thought, you know, when I saw Hook back in the summer at Blood and Guts and sat ringside for that show, Hook was impressive in terms of his presence. I thought that when he came out for that opening match with Jack Perry, he had a star-like presence, and the crowd was very much into him at that time. I think that they were into the feud overall, and it gave me some hope that in the future there could be something more with him. I don't know if it'll ever reach the heights that maybe some people thought it could in the early going, but I thought that, you know, there is something there. And I do agree, tonight was an overall a pretty good night for him. And I thought, you know, being in the ring with Moxley and with Wheeler Yuta was a net positive. I mean, he looked good overall. I liked that pinning combination finish, the belt buckle finish. It was or the seat belt pin. It was a cool finish, and something that you would expect the Blackpool Combat Club to pull out.
So what do you expect with, going back to Moxie and Cassidy, and then we'll switch to the next thing. What do you expect in that match, and then what's next for both of them?
I'm inclined to think that Moxley may get the title back, because it feels like that we're sort of on a detour that was unplanned. Moxley loses the title to Rey Fénix after the concussion, and it seems very clear that was not the direction that they were hoping to go. They get the title quickly back on Orange Cassidy, and we end up here, which feels like maybe a match that they were planning to do anyway. I think it makes sense to go back to Moxley, but I'm also not opposed to having Cassidy go on another interesting run, if it means that he's going to continue to explore this darker side of himself. By the same token, though, I think you can still explore that by having Moxley win, because if Cassidy no longer has the U.S. champion, the international championship, he can remain obsessed with getting it back and with with getting vengeance for his second loss to Jon Moxley. So I think they have a compelling story either way if they want to continue this. I do hope that before too long, though, for the sake of Moxley's position and the Blackpool Combat Club's position, that they do get away from this feud with Cassidy and his, you know, the people in his periphery, Best Friends, for example. I didn't like when Yuta and Moxley and Claudio were essentially wrestling Best Friends on a weekly basis. I just thought it was beneath the Blackpool Combat Club as a whole. I could certainly see them being strong candidates to go after the Don Callis family once Omega and company are done with them. And I think that that is a really good spot for the BCC, which would allow them to just fully assimilate into being babyfaces.
Yes, I like that. We talk sometimes about how WWE wants fans thinking about 2.5 things at the end of their show, like two major feuds and then maybe one secondary or, you know, kind of a third one, but not as forceful. And AEW kind of followed that formula because MJF Jay White was a big thing. I would say the half would be Orange and Moxley. Maybe you could argue Young Bucks and Golden Jets, they kind of got a segment too, but the other major segment that they hyped was the one that involved the home invasion. And we had Tony Schiavone, as I alluded to earlier, saying something that I wish they'd do more often, which is, set rules and explain the stakes so that you understand why the rules are being followed. Of course, it does, you know, prompt people to wonder, why don't they do that all the time if it's effective? But then pro wrestling could be pro wrestling. I mean, it could be, actually. It would just be different. So Hangman unleashed on Swerve Strickland. I liked this promo better than his last one. The last one where it's like, I'm going to take my son to your grave every year and watch him piss in your grave was just awkward, weird imagery. And it just felt heavy. And it was just like one thing after another, you know, you're going to burn in hell forever. It's like everything you could imagine things. Yeah.
And you can't do any of it. You're not going to kill a guy.
Exactly. That's the thing. I mean, so, you know, and that's the problem with the home invasion angle. So, you know, there's just no way for a promo to do it. So I like this better because it felt odd to say, given he called him a worthless waste of life, a little less heavy-handed. Again, I really like Hangman's delivery. I just wish the angle was about something that didn't feel so out of bounds, you know, going into his home. Swerve didn't get to talk, but he got to react with his facial expressions and body language to Hangman being in a rage. There's some meta stuff about, you know, oh, you got fired and your fiance left you and you can't see your kids. And I was like, that's just why are we bringing that in? It's not part of canon yet. So it's sort of a weird thing to bring in late in the game. And it's kind of a tendency that I think people in AEW have, which is, oh, we'll add a little something real and that'll really put this promo over. And it's like, yeah, if people don't know what you're talking about, it's a distraction. So I'm ripping on it a little bit, but there's still something about how good Hangman is when he gets in that rhythm. You know, there's a little Dusty Rhodes, a little James Storm, just that intensity and the charisma and the sincerity of that comes across in his comments, that sometimes the words and the content matter less than just how determined he comes across. And so he pulled me in that way. So I want to hear what you thought, Brandon, of this segment and Hangman mostly, but also Swerve's reactions. And then also the Prince Nana element. And if you thought it was good to add the weed comments also.
Very, very similar thoughts overall. I loved the outline of this. I loved the setup and the intensity of it all, because I think that if you're going to go to a Texas death match and if you're going to essentially follow up on Hangman Page threatening to commit murder last week, then you want to make sure that you have an intense go home promo that is, if nothing else, more grounded in reality. I mean, Paige made reference to sort of murder again, but in a less obvious way. So that was nice that he pulled back on that, even if I would have liked them to sort of retcon the whole thing, because again, when you go that far in pro wrestling, it's very hard to take it seriously because everyone knows that they're not going to kill each other. So it's something I would prefer that they leave out, but I really like the intensity, the passion from Hangman. He's really, really good when he is in this position. This is a really, really strong secondary feud for the company. The only complaint I have about it is that it does, to some extent, feel like a living embodiment of the, well, that escalated quickly. It sort of went from Swerve Strickland targeting Hangman Page because he wanted his spot. And in fact, I think Swerve did an excellent job at explaining exactly why he targeted Hangman Page.
Yeah.
That's something that I don't know that got really enough credit, because so often in a secondary feud like this, where you just have two contenders who are going to wrestle each other, the feud is very ambiguous, and they jump to a really quick conclusion to make it personal. And to both Hangman and Swerve's credit, and whoever, you know, was producing their segments, they did a really good job at Swerve laying the outline for the fact that this was not at all personal to him in the beginning. He had no ill will toward Hangman Page other than the fact that Page was in the spot that he believed that he belonged in. And so in order to get to that spot, he needed to take it from Hangman Page. And I thought he did an excellent job explaining that. I thought that Page did a really good job in responding to it. So then to immediately go from that to, well, now this is a blood feud and I'm going to break into your house, was
right.
a little
unnecessary.
It felt like a little much. Now, at the same time, I understand that they needed an excuse to get to this Texas death match. So I think there were better ways to do it. With that being said, I think that they did a good job executing tonight and doing a good job solidifying the position that I think they rushed into. So overall, I thought it was a strong segment. I thought that Swerve's facial expressions were really good. He's been very good at that all along. I love the fire from Hangman Page. Prince Nana provided a bit of levity to a segment that I think was largely very, very heavy in nature, and I don't dislike that. The weed comment was whatever. I mean, it felt like AEW trying to be a little bit edgy for the sake of being a little bit edgy. And that, you know, I could take it or leave it. It didn't bother me. Do I think that there's a more natural way for something like that to come up? Yeah, for sure. But I didn't think it took away from things overall.
Yeah. You mentioned, well, they had to get to the Texas death match. And I guess my question is, why? Why does that have to even be a thing? This feels like, well, it's a pay-per-view and we got to add a little something extra. But they haven't really stressed that. Like, if you're going to have a Texas death match, like, make a big deal out of it. I know they do so many gimmick matches and it's hard to get back to the place where, you know, adding a stipulation was something that, you know, you could really isolate and frame as a big deal. But I also don't think you should give up on it by just throwing it out there as, oh, it's just something we're doing. So I would have been fine with Hangman and Swerve fighting in a rematch over the spot and raising the game without a home invasion. And I think there would have been other ways to get to Texas death if that's what they wanted to do.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And did the announcement of Texas death come, was that a response to the home invasion? I'm trying to remember if I have that right.
I'm not sure of the timing of it, but
okay.
I mean, I don't think they would have had a reason to do it unless they added something else.
Yeah, I think the home invasion happened and then Hangman Page basically declared a Texas death match. So I think it was in response to that. But yeah, I mean, with the amount of stipulations that AEW regularly puts on its shows, I mean, you had a massive brawl tonight on Dynamite. I mean, you don't even have to look to pay-per-view for it. I mean, they do it all the time. So yeah, I mean, Page and Swerve proved already that they can have a heck of a one-on-one match without any stipulation. I think that they could have had a varied enough match to not go that route, and I probably would have preferred it.
So a big question is Swerve on the path to being at the level of being a world champion? That is something I'm not convinced. But I am not against them aiming him that direction. How do you think he's doing, and how do you think fans perceive him if that is a direction that they're considering moving towards at some point, like Swerve as a heel against Faith MJF, for example, or otherwise.
I think that it is definitely a direction that they should aim for. I'm not 100% confident that he gets there, but I certainly think that there is a good shot that he could. And given the amount of time that they've put into building him to this point, and the level of commitment I think that he's shown to working this style, to being sort of a face of the company, I think you have to play it out to its end and see what you have. I think that he is an incredibly talented wrestler with a great look and a ton of charisma, and I think that you have to take your shot and see what you have. As far as crowd and their reactions to him, honestly, for guys that aren't really established in a particular role within AEW right now, it's been so hard for me to feel like I have an accurate read on how fans are perceiving them, because the crowds have not been all that vocal. They've been coming up for the things that you would expect them to come up for, the established acts, the moves, the moments and the matches that they're sort of preconditioned to cheer for. But the crowds have been small, for one. And tonight, for example, it felt like they were mic'd really poorly. And I don't know if it was just not a particularly loud crowd, but man, there was so much on this show where I just felt like, Even in recent weeks where I am keenly aware of, you know, gaps in the audience and the poor attendance, I'm still getting the reactions to things that I'm expecting. And tonight was not the case there. So I don't know. I don't know how the fans are going to perceive him. I think that there's certainly interest there. I mean, I think there's definitely a level of engagement with Prince Nana and his dancing. I think that there is an interest in Swerve Strickland at the level he's at, but I am definitely curious to see what the reaction would be at the next level.
Is Hangman Page in a worse spot than over the last couple of years, a better spot or kind of the same spot? And who do you think is going to have more pay-per-view, like top three matches, top four matches on pay-per-views over the next couple of years, Swerve or Hangman, or is it going to be close?
Oh, wow. I would say Paige. So Paige had that really disappointing run as champion. His world title run was very much overshadowed by the Summer of Punk and everything going on there. And then the controversy that followed it. It felt like Hangman's title win was supposed to be the crowning of a new face of the company and wound up falling pretty short of that. I think by the time they got to it, it was good, but it fell a little flatter than I think they had anticipated and even I had anticipated. And then some poor booking along the way led to it being a pretty underwhelming title run, and one that actually, given that he was sort of cut off by CM Punk, it's sort of funny that it almost mirrored Punk's reign, where he was not main eventing pay-per-views and was being overshadowed by the likes of John Cena and The Rock. So similar situation there, and an interesting little anecdote. I think that at this point, I think we know what we're getting with Hangman Page. And we've seen him at the top. We've seen what it is. It doesn't preclude him from being at the top again in the future. But I think right now it's more important to see what you have out of Swerve. So I would give a slight edge to Swerve Strickland in terms of main event level pay-per-view matches over the next couple of years. But it would not surprise me if I were wrong. I don't think this is a runaway by any stretch of the imagination. I could very easily see it being Hangman. As far as where Hangman is at, I think he is in
just on placement on the card basis alone, I think he's beneath where he was during his world title run for obvious reasons. He's just not at that level right now. But he is a fair step above where he was post-championship run, where I felt like he really was lost there for a while.
All right, let's shift to talking about the women's match on the show and the Toni Storm segment of the show. And we'll bring on David Bryant, who is the PW Torch hits and misses author following the AEW Collision hits and misses columnist for the website. David, welcome. Thanks for calling up. I know you have a particular passion for the women's division and a ongoing frustration with the women's division in AEW. You can start with either the Sky Blue Red Velvet match or the Toni Storm segment as it relates to building up the pay-per-view. And welcome. Hello. David, can you hear us? Could be a switchboard issue. David, are you there? All right, I'll check back with him. Like I said, we're having some technical issues. So I'll get your take first, Brandon. The Toni Storm Sheeta match got hyped by having Toni Storm, a segment with her in her locker room, asking for a warm-up match. I enjoy things going to black and white when they go into her world, her universe. It is a creative license I'm willing to extend, a rare creative license, because I think the gimmick is well done otherwise, and distinct, and Toni Storm is just a riot playing it. We had Mariah May as sort of her super fan, wanting to meet her, Toni Storm, with cucumbers on her eyes, saying she came across her indisposed, and she wasn't happy with the interruption. So what do you think of that segment, and how did it serve selling Toni Storm as a potential champion who unseats Hikaru Shida?
I liked it overall, as I tend to do with most of these Toni Storm segments. I think they've hit something for sure with her. It's funny that maybe one of the better things to ever come out of the AEW women's division, and the bar is unfortunately quite low, but one of the better things to really come out of that division since its inception is a gimmick and a presentation that is straight out of WWE. I mean, this is the more comedic side of pro wrestling that WWE very frequently does, but doesn't often do well. And I do think that this is on the much higher end of that style of gimmick. It's not particularly believable, and yet it's so entertaining and endearing that you are willing to suspend disbelief and just enjoy it for what it is. And I think she's doing a heck of a job with the character. I am also a fan of the black and white, though I would actually prefer it be a tongue-in-cheek acknowledgement that this is something that she requires and has written into her contract, and essentially that she would like to be presented this way, and that the camera should turn when she is on screen. I think it would add yet another element to the character and the craziness that is this, 1920 starlet. I think that she is, so with the AEW women's title, I'm often in the mindset of, they need to establish a champion and stick with her for a longer period of time. So this is going to go against the opinion I would normally hold. They've put the championship on Hikaru Shida multiple times. I don't think it's ever really clicked, and that's nothing against Hikaru Shida. It just doesn't seem like a particularly strong act to anchor the division around at any given time. I think that Toni Storm, given how over she is right now, how well this character is clicking, and some of the innovative and funny but also effective things that that character could do with the championship, I would move the title to her. that could also be dependent on, you know, is it Mercedes Moné coming in on Saturday? That could sway the decision one way or another. But personally, I think with that division, with how problematic it has been, you should strike while the iron is hot and you have something that is genuinely over and genuinely being enjoyed, and go with Tony Storm.
All right, let's try David Bryant again. David, do we have you this time?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, we sure can.
Is it working?
Great.
Oh, yeah. Wow, thank goodness. I that was my bad. I accidentally hit the mute button. Or at least I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
Oh, okay.
Cool. You were talking about the women's division.
Yes.
Right. And I have a lot to say about that. I say a lot of it in my collision hits and misses column every week. I love women's division. I love in women's wrestling and wrestling in general. And I feel like AEW is really missing the train by not capitalizing on an entire demographic. Women's wrestling doesn't just appeal to women. It also appeals to gay wrestling fans. I know because me and my boyfriend, we love that. And I hear people talking about it among my friends. You know, talk about the women wrestlers in AEW, and they say, oh, man, but WWE is so much better. And I, as a fan of AEW and someone who's followed them since the beginning, would really like AEW to be in that conversation. The first match tonight, and I want to be clear that I like Sky Blue. I like Red Velvet. I remember writing a match, covering a match of theirs for Dark Elevation, in which the entire match was puns about color. And they have a lot of potential, and they have at some times capitalized on that potential. And tonight was not one of those times to me. I wanted to see what you guys thought of the match, but to me, some of the things that stood out, and I know Red Velvet's new, and she's coming back, and she's new to the ring, she's got ring rust, but her standing moonsault, she hesitated before taking off. She took off. Her hips looked like it, you know, kind of crashed into almost Sky Blue's lower chest area rather than, you know, getting her stomach over her stomach. There was, I'm trying to think of other moments. The Code Blue at the end, I don't know if it wasn't Red Velvet, wasn't able to get herself up enough, or if Sky Blue wasn't able to get her up enough for what it was, but it looked like she almost did a gonzo bomb, but thank God she didn't, you know, like on her head. It looked like she rolled out, the referee didn't check on her head. There were a couple of other moments in the match that just felt like people who could be really great wrestlers if they just had the reps. And I wonder if maybe AEW should do something like require newer wrestlers to have, well, Sky Blue, she debuted wrestling at 18, so it's not like she's brand new, she's 24 now, but to have wrestlers that are still working to polish their craft do a certain number of reps a week. Would it benefit them to have a performance center? So I know they had, the Cody and QT Marshall, that they had their factory out that they were working on. But would it behoove them to have something different and more organized? I know I thought out a lot of stuff, but what do you guys think?
Yeah, so Brandon, your thoughts on the match itself that David's talking about, and the work, and then David's idea too of finding a way to get the women more reps to both, I would argue for Chris Statlander's sake, more practice on the microphone, more character development, more working in front of live audiences. You know, they lost AEW Dark as a place to do that. But again, start with your thoughts on the Velvet Sky match tonight.
Yeah, I didn't think it was a particularly strong match, and I enjoy Sky Blue as well. I think that there's something there. It's very raw. You know, she's obviously very inexperienced, but I think that she's connected with the fans on a certain level that
a lot of AEW talent, especially the undercard women, have really struggled to do. And so when you have someone that seems to build a connection over time, I think it's important that you take advantage of it and you continue to feature them. So Sky has been featured very, very regularly across all three AEW TV shows lately. And I think that's a good thing for her experience, but it also doesn't always create a great presentation for the fan watching at home. And unfortunately, because AEW is want to only present one women's match per show, it can leave the undiscerning fan at home with a bit of a negative connotation with the division. And I think that's a problem. I mean, WWE can present a show with only one women's match, and maybe the match isn't particularly good, but they've established themselves over the course of many years now as having a strong track record of main event women's matches. And AEW just doesn't have that. So when they don't have that track record of established stars with established main events and credibility for your championships and your champions, you have a much shorter leash with the audience and much, you know, lower expectations. And I rarely do I find that they really hit on those expectations. And it's part of the reason that I'm so down on the division as a whole. I think what you bring up about establishing some sort of place where not just the women, but some of the younger male talent as well can gain additional exposure would be really good for, especially in the case of the women's division, a more well-rounded product and presentation. The problem with that, of course, is that, you know, like you mentioned, Wade, getting rid of Dark and Dark Elevation, on the one hand, it's better on a lot of the talent, a lot of the production. It's a lot to produce that much TV, and there's already so much TV that AEW is producing on a weekly basis. I would argue too much. So to add more is really not a great situation. But by the same token, you also don't want to send this talent out to like indie shows where they run the risk of getting injured, you know, not on your watch. It's a tough situation that they're in. And so maybe a performance center is, or something akin to a performance center is a strong option. I don't know if that's something that they would consider or are maybe already considering, but I don't think it would hurt. I mean, there's certainly plenty of talent that could benefit from some time there, both in the ring and on the microphone, Wade, like you mentioned with Chris Statlander, who I think does a disservice to her presentation pretty much every time she has a microphone.
What was she doing tonight? Caressing that belt like Dr. Evil petting his hairless cat in Austin Powers. That was so weird.
Every time I really enjoy Chris Statlander in the ring, and I think that she's a fascinating character and you know, brings a lot to the table, but I struggle to think of a worse promo on a main roster right now. I don't believe anything she says at any point in time. Nothing she says is believable to me.
And I don't think we have a sense of who she is. I mean, yeah, I just, there's nothing, you couldn't really explain who she is to anybody either. David, do you have a theory on what was going on with Statlander and that while she was watching the match backstage, stroking her belt?
I don't know. Chris Statlander, and I actually don't think they should take the title off of her. I think that she, because I, and Brandon mentioned it, but I think that there's something there. She has a great look. You know, she's tall. She's got a great look. She's really good in the ring. In fact, especially for AEW, as far as the way she tells stories and her facial expressions in the ring, to me, they really do click in telling those stories. It's the backstage segments. It's the interviews that she's had. Actually, the sit-down interviews aren't as bad as when she's trying to talk. It's when she's trying to talk they had mentioned it, and I mentioned it in my column last week. It was just a particularly egregious moment, and it's so unfortunate because I feel like I can see her trying hard, and I can. It's just like she's just trying to learn to drive, and she's trying so hard, but you can see the ditch is about to run into like a mile ahead, and then it happens, and she just pointed at her title belt, and then apparently seemed to forget what title she held. She was like, "You would have shot at this thing," and that was so deflating in that moment. And there's a lot of little things, the certainty of where she places her hands. You know, I did a really long, I wrote like about 600 or 700 words in a single column. I know we have to find it, about Chris Statlander and what things I thought, as someone who has directed actors, could help her. But I think the biggest thing that could help her, and the thing I don't understand why they haven't done, is get her a manager not named Mark Stilling that would literally take her to the next level, because historically Winnie Wrester has a lot to offer, and you can tell they do, but they just can't articulate what they have to offer. That's the role of the manager, is to tell that story for them. Brock Lesnar, the version that we know and love of him, was pretty much made by Paul Heyman's voice. And that's what she needs. She needs a voice behind her. I don't want to give up on that project. And I'm so glad she got rid of the alien gimmick, because the booping and the whatever that was. But I don't like the new gimmick of car crash carnival wordplay. It's not working out well in the promos. And she should focus on being a tough butt person in the ring, you know, similar to the way Serena Deeb did. You know, someone who just dominates in the ring. Focus on not saying a whole lot, and have somebody else that can speak for her, because I think you can make money with Chris Statlander. I really do. But I just can't make money with Chris Statlander when she's the one talking, if that makes any sense.
David, what do you think is going to happen in the Statlander-Julia Hart Sky Blue match at Full Gear? And then after David gives his take, Brandon, give your prediction or thoughts on that and the build to it, too.
I would like to see Statlander come out on top. I have a feeling they're going to go with Julia Hart. It's just a gut feeling. Julia Hart, I remember how bad she was. She is a great example of a success story. She was like so much worse than the bunny. I'm trying to think of the.
I don't know about that.
She was worse than Brandi Rhodes. I don't know. I do know, because I watched. She was like worse than Brandi Rhodes. Like, she was so awkward in the ring that I would almost want to pause when I was watching Elevation, just to, you know, you have that secondhand embarrassment, and it's like too much embarrassment, and you want to pause the show to try to absorb it before you go back into it. That was a Julia Hart match back then. And now a Julia Hart match is really entertaining. I think I linked in one of my reports to an older Julia Hart match, because it's almost unbelievable, the transformation that she's made, and I kind of wanted the reader to believe it. That actually, you know, this is what Barrett started, and this is how it's going, and wow. And part of that is they found what works for her. Yes, she is a national cheerleading champion, you know, but that doesn't mean she has to be a cheerleader as a gimmick. And they saw that she isn't a great talker, and they put her in a place where she didn't have to do a lot of talking. She could be around a really prominent staple. She could have a prominent look, get face time on TV. And while all of that is happening, in the background, she can learn the craft of professional wrestling. And I feel like she has learned it. I'm not saying she's Charlotte Flair, but she's also not the Bunny. And I feel so bad. I think the Bunny is trying to get better, too. But she is improving. And I think that the audience has taken notice of that. I think that Tony Khan has taken notice of that by the way he's been pushing her lately. I think there's a chance that they put that title on her. You know, I could almost see the argument for it if I didn't think that we should just try to stick with Statlander, because there was so much collateral in the bank of Jade Cargill that was spent on Chris Statlander when she won. And I just don't want to cut the losses yet. I think we can get something there. But I think they're going to go with Julia Hart.
Yeah.
Just my opinion. I'm probably
wrong. And Brandon, David brings up that point about Jade Cargill, and it's like, when I think of Statlander, I don't even think of that anymore, and it's hard for AEW to draw attention to it, because you're drawing attention to the fact that someone who's going to be a much bigger star in WWE than they ever were for you, and a bigger star than any wrestler you have on your roster in the women's division, is someone you lost, and then Statlander, who's stumbling her way through promos and bad story, or I shouldn't say bad storylines, but bad promos, and then whatever. Not top-level, buzz-generating storylines, at least. Is who beat her. And I don't think there's a lot of cachet to protect there.
No, and I think they've spent most of it already, unfortunately, just with the way that they've handled Statlander. I mean, when Statlander was the one to beat Cargill, I was an advocate of going really, really all in with Statlander and continuing to present that TBS championship in a really significant way and treat Statlander like a star, because they treated Jade like a star and she became a star. And she brought a lot of credibility to that championship. And for a while there, I think the TBS championship had more cachet and more credibility than the women's world title did, simply because of the way that it was booked and the way that Jade was presented versus the way that they were so apt to play hot potato with the world title. And when they failed to capitalize on any of that with Jade and with Chris, and instead just moved her into sort of random feud after random feud, where she beats her opponent in relatively dominant fashion and then moves on, disappears from TV for a couple weeks, associates herself primarily with best friends and Orange Cassidy, isn't taken particularly seriously. I thought that the stock that they built and the opportunity that they had was gone. I expect her to retain, or to see Julia Hart win the title and pin Sky Blue. I think they're going to try to protect Chris as much as they can. Now, I was a very strong advocate of pulling the trigger on Julia Hart last month against Chris Statlander. And that is not because I think that they should give up on Chris Statlander by any stretch. In fact, I think that pulling the trigger on Julia would have served two purposes. One, Julia was on a really impressive run. At the time, she had won 28 matches in a row. She'd done so quietly, but they had done a nice job of starting to build it up on television. Or on the main shows anyway, because she was doing a lot of that winning on, you know, Rampage and whatnot. So it establishes, or it continues her long-running streak. It gives a championship to the House of Black, which I think provides them with some credibility and also allows them to rally around Julia Hart as this figurehead for a bit of time, which would have been a fresh presentation for them. But on the other side of the coin, you have Chris Statlander, who won the championship. We sort of hope to see a fresh presentation, a main event focus, all those sort of things that we saw with Jay Cargill. We didn't get any of that. And I think giving her a hard reset, taking the title off of her, having her go through the agony of defeat and realizing that she didn't live up to what she set out to do, and having her find herself, because if she finds herself, then we as fans and we the audience watching will find her as well and find a better understanding and a better grasp on the character that they've done such a poor job telling the story of. So I would have gone with Julia then. I think it's a less attractive story to tell in a triple threat match or a three-way match. So I think for me, I would keep the title on Statlander here and do more of the tease between Julia and Sky Blue and whether Sky Blue is going to join the House of Black as a result of the Mist. And then if you want to pull the trigger on Julia, you do so in a one-on-one match shortly thereafter.
All right. I want to go back to David and get his thoughts on the Toni Storm skit, which we talked about. And, David, your prediction for the Shida Storm match.
Okay. Of course, I love the skit. It had the one thing I love in AEW that makes something great, and that's Toni Storm. She was definitely in it, and therefore I love it. I particularly enjoyed every time they opened the door and it went to black and white. That was great. Toni Storm has become a walking meme. Now, that brings up the question, is being a walking meme enough to be the world champion? And I do think that Toni Storm would make a fantastic women's champion. She's already held it twice technically, and I think this character can do it. But I think there needs to be a couple of tweaks, and they could do this fairly quickly. Is that she can be as zany and fun and as much of a Twitter meme and a TikTok clip as she wants to be on the show, because it's great. But they need to do is what they did with Orange Cassidy, which is when the bell rings, the BS stops. Like, when the bell rings, there might be a few mind games, but you know she can go. And that's what the focus should be there. The second focus, I liked the skit, but I liked the skit, but I was a little confused about why that skit on this day, because we are like 5 days away, from a world title match against Shida, you know, who's multi-time women's champion and is considered to be very dominant by the fans. And it would have been great to have Storm in her character, in all of her zaniness and all of her just glorious swallowed the ghost of John Crawford abilities, address the match that's coming up on the Saturday that she's in theory, given that there's the men's champion, the women's championship, she would be in the top two major draws, ideally, for that show. And the draw for her right now is how much people are really into her character, and I'm really into her character. And I've long thought Toni Storm had a ton of potential. I mean, she started when she was like 13 She left home and to go and train in Australia, outside of Brisbane, and you know she came here at a young age. She trained with WWE. She worked with a lot of different companies. She ended up with WWE. They didn't seem to truly appreciate her, and you know now she's here, and I think she is appreciated. I think she's found her voice. In this character, and it's so rare for someone to, you know, who didn't find their voice at the very first moment they stepped on the stage to find it later, and she's really found that. You know, when writers talk about what makes a Stephen King book better than, Joe Blow book, a lot of it isn't the story he's telling, it's the voice he's telling it in. And Toni Storm has found the right voice, and now she's got to find the right story to tell with it.
Brandon, David brought up a good point. Why are we doing a skit with a fangirl who's new and hasn't been firmly established just days before the pay-per-view title match, and we don't hear from Shida, and we don't get a lot of talk about what's at stake? If you're going to do have a serious women's title match, it seems like you'd want to treat it more seriously than they are here, even if you also are embracing the Toni Storm even if you're embracing the Toni Storm character and her zany quirks, what do you say to that? Or is this just kind of telling us Mariah May is probably going to cost Toni Storm the match or help Toni Storm win, and those would maybe be the top two options for finishes.
There's certainly no argument for me. I think that you want to do everything in your power to present the women's world title and for that matter, the TBS championship as credible, significant feuds on pay-per-view. And if you take a look at the card for Saturday, I mean, these two matches are in contention for least amount of build. I mean, they're there because you have a champion and you have a contender, or in the case of the TBS title, two contenders. But more often than not, this is just the style of booking in the AEW women's division. And it's why I have had such a negative view of it for such a long period of time. It just tends to feel like they throw things together without much thought or consideration, and you do get characters that connect and segments that work on a week-to-week basis, but the booking ultimately fails them. And it doesn't mean that Sheeta and Storm can't have a really good match and that, you know, whoever comes out the victor can't be better off for it, but it just speaks to the lack of importance that is assigned to this division as a whole, and it's unfortunate. I do think that they would be much better served if we had seen something from Sheeta, or if Toni had cut some sort of promo to talk more about the match and the challenge that she faces in the champion. So I think they can still do these comedic segments that work really well and are obviously very well received, while also presenting a serious case for two rivals squaring off for the championship. But the problem is they just don't seem interested in having that many women's segments.
David, I appreciate the call. Do you have any quick closing words about our topics?
No, I guess the last thing I would say is, I think Brandon was mentioning it, but about Vince strike with the iron is hot. He was talking about Julia Hart and striking with the iron is hot, and how it might be a little bit less now. And that is such an epidemic in AEW. It doesn't mean to never strike. I still think Toni Storm should win on a Sunday based on the T-shirt, you know, sells formula on she's selling the most. But I think that, and she's very entertaining, but striking when the iron's hot is so important. Honestly, I think they should have struck the iron's hot with Toni Storm at Grand Slam. And I guess the thing I'd leave you with, you know, is that Tony Khan is the king of catch and release, and I'm not sure that he knows it. That's the...
Great. All right. David, good having you part of the show to especially help us cover the women's division, get another point of view.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, you bet. Check out his columns on AEW Collision, Hits and Misses, at pwtorch.com. Brandon, I want to get your take. Maybe this will be our last main topic here before we wrap up, on the street fight, the eight-man street fight. Paul White being slammed off a platform onto the hood and windshield of a car by Hobbs, and that looked like it could go really wrong. We had Kyle Fletcher. I'm trying to think of all the people who almost died or got paralyzed in this match.
Kota Ibushi.
Yes. So my kind of baseline philosophy on this type of thing is, don't be gratuitous with big, dangerous spots just to get a pop. Save those big spots so that when they happen, you can really make a big deal out of them, which they are with Max Caster, by the way. He went through, you know, candy glass, whatever they call that fake glass that doesn't cut you, in this obviously, you know, made-up office that doesn't look like any office. You know, why would there be a big glass window? But they you know, that's – you got to have, I guess, creative license to not roll your eyes at the staging of it. But at least they're – he's not just popping up this week and acting like nothing happened. There's so many big spots in that match, and I know it's like fun in the moment for so many fans, and they don't look at wrestling in a way where it diminishes it when there's all these, you know, big spots that wrestlers just get up from. But I also don't know that they know, like, how much better it would be if these big spots meant more when they happened, and they didn't, the effect didn't seem so ephemeral. And it, you know, when one of these things happened, it was, you know, course changing, career changing, match ending at least. Now, I give credit, Big Show didn't get up after that spot.
Yeah.
So that was good. Yeah. Your thoughts overall, Brandon, on this? I mean, it was a, you know, if Jim Ross was there, he would have been calling it a train wreck of a brawl, or, you know, he'd have come up with something to describe the chaos and all that.
Oh, he'd have been so mad. He would have been trying so hard to keep it in, but it would have escaped. You know, the ornery JR would have been all over that match. Speaking to the level of violence and moves that are executed with pretty much zero regard for the damage that they should realistically cause. I mean, even in not this crazy brawl tonight, it was sort of like Hangman Page's Deadeye on the apron. I think it was Penta who executed it on one of the Bucks, and it was just like glossed over, like it was just a suplex. Like it was a real serious, like he got dropped on his head on the edge of the ring and we just moved on like nothing happened.
Yeah.
And that's kind of par for the course with AEW. And it's one of the things that I wish they would pull back on a little bit. Cause you do get shows that have less of it for a time. And then it's like every once in a while, they'll just bust out a random Dynamite where it's like, you're going to go, you know, sort of all the way with these moves that may not even necessarily be dangerous. They just look vicious and violent and should be more effective than they are. And it becomes harder to suspend disbelief because of that. But as far as this brawl, I mean, it wasn't for me. I got a kick out of the fact that Jericho and Paul White came to the ring in their suits, but Kota and Kenny changed into actual ring gear. So they no longer matched. The promotion was a bit over the top. I don't like it when WWE does it. I don't like it when AEW does it. I understand why they do, and so it's not a huge complaint at the end of the day, but man, did they lean heavily into it for this. I hope they got a really good payday for it. Let's put it that way. I thought it was just sort of gratuitous nonsense. I mean, not like the entertaining level of violence, more like the hokey slapstick kind of pro wrestling that just doesn't really work for me. And I thought, especially given how serious we're kind of supposed to take the Kenny Omega and Don Callis feud, that it just felt a little bit beneath it. And yeah, some of the unnecessary risks, like Kota Ibushi, for example, that just felt like going way overboard on a random episode of Dynamite. It was just too much.
Yeah. It gets to sort of the comment about the Texas Deathmatch earlier where, you know, you just sort of throwing something extra in as a substitute for something that maybe is genuinely safer or looks safer and means more. That said, I mean, you know, okay. So the bicycle ride and the blows with a pipe were just zany, silly nonsense. And if somebody hates the match because they had to sell this, like, you know, it just doesn't even look heavy in your hand when you're swinging at people and they go down, that was just dumb and not worth it. But the other spots with the bicycle, the clothesline off it and then the slamming on top of it, that felt genuinely hardcore. And, you know, and sort of we're dissecting the chain and the pedals and all the things that could do damage. So it was just, to me, it wasn't consistent. It was like, hey, look at us brawling around, having fun, hitting each other with things that, you know, you might do if you had your middle school friends over for an Saturday afternoon play wrestling, which is, you know, not what you should be going for. But then there were other things that were like just deadly. So it just, to me, the tone just wasn't consistent enough. And I didn't think this match knew what it was. It didn't seem like it had decided what it wanted to be other than I have an idea. Let's do this. Let's do that. And then they just did it all. And of course, Brian Cage gets pinned because that's the rule.
Yeah, and Don Callis gets in the comment about, you know, that it's all his fault and they're, this isn't over. And I mean, it makes sense. It keeps the Callis family strong. It sends the message that the Brian Cage partnership is likely not long for this world, and that he really was just a simple hired gun. I look at the wrestlers involved here. I look at Kenny Omega, and I look at Konosuke Takeshita, and I look at Powerhouse Hobbs, and I just want better for them at this point. Kota Ibushi too. I mean, you can say that about Jericho, but like at this point, he's a Teflon legacy act who can really just do whatever. I would prefer better for the rest of those guys. And the thing is too, is that like, they don't need this kind of thing as a crutch either. I mean, they're not like someone like Chris Jericho, who might be better served by working a style of match like this to make up for some of the deficiencies that come with aging. Whereas these other guys, Ibushi and Omega, yes, they have a storied history of injuries, but they're still very much capable wrestlers in the ring. Powerhouse Hobbs, Konosuke Takeshita, all of these guys are very talented wrestlers, and I'd rather just see them wrestle.
Yeah, I would too. I would too. It seems like we're trying to differentiate ourselves with, you know, something that is an OMG spot one after another, and then some, you know, knee slapping comedy spots too.
But the thing is that they do those matches. They do like the, oh my God, this is incredibly barbaric and violent matches very well. And so when they dilute those with something like this, I think it lessens the effectiveness of the whole thing.
Yeah. I agree. Brandon, anything else you want to sneak in before we sign off here? Anything else from the show we didn't talk about? Maybe with Samoa Joe and the guns and the squash win. I don't think there's too much we haven't discussed pretty in-depth otherwise. Oh, we had that Miro CJ, you know, the Miro promo too.
Yeah, I like what they're doing with Miro. I'm still a little confused as to what the Redeemer is. I mean, I know like it was he was making a lot of references and allusions to his gods, and now, you know, he no longer needs his gods. He's telling other people to pray to them. It was a good line. I just don't know what it really means for his character long term. But I like the dichotomy between him and CJ Perry. I mean, CJ is a charismatic figure, and I think that she's a good person to have around overall. And I'm intrigued by her involvement in this storyline. I think that the chemistry between her and Miro is great, and they're trying something that may not work, but I applaud them for giving it a go. And then the last thing I would want to say is just a lot of praise for Samoa Joe. I think that him laying down the ROH Television Championship, I was very happy to see him do it. For one, because I want to see less championships on AEW TV as a whole. Second, I think that he is far more important and far better than that championship, regardless of whether or not he was raising its status by holding on to it for such a long period of time. It was so clearly beneath him, and I think that he is still a good enough wrestler and a good enough talker and a valuable enough asset that you really don't want to be wasting what's left of his career in what this version of ROH is. He should really be a full-blown, full-time AEW main roster guy, and I thought that taking the championship off of him was a clear signal that that is the direction that they're going. And I really, really like his attitude, the way that he is approaching this potential partnership with MJF, because it is so unapologetically Samoa Joe. It is exactly what Samoa Joe would do. He is willing to come to the aid of MJF as a hired gun, not for money, but for a guaranteed championship opportunity. And one could easily look at that and say, well, why would Samoa Joe care whether or not he beats MJF for the championship or Jay White for the championship? And the answer is so clear because of who Samoa Joe is,
because MJF beat Samoa Joe, and that is eating away at him. He doesn't want to take the title off of Jay White because Jay White is not the guy that beat him. MJF is, and he needs to beat MJF for that title. I like it. I like it a lot. It is just – it is exactly what Samoa Joe would do. It is so true to that character, and you don't get that all the time with characters in AEW, in WWE. You don't get characters who are so completely and unapologetically true to themselves and who they've been, and that's what this is with Joe.
I love it. Brandon, anything else?
No.
That
covers it.
It's fun seeing Joe used as Joe at his best. Like what you just said, just framing. It's like sometimes, it's like Moxley, just Moxley. Like just, I mean, there's just some people who are just themselves and they feel authentic. And those are the wrestlers who succeed and fans feel that connection to them because it, you know, somewhere, I mean, that's not to rip on people who add a gimmick to try to enhance what they are, but Joe doesn't feel like a gimmick. You know, Moxie doesn't feel like a gimmick, even if there's, you know, ring gear and amplification of their voice.
Yes. Yeah. And he's and with Joe, he's a prize fighter and he's a pride fighter. And it makes so much sense why he would want MJF to be the champion, because he wants his pride, because he lost to him, and he wants his prize.
Yep, very good. Brandon, thank you. You'll be covering Full Gear Saturday night.
Yeah, I'll be covering Full Gear Saturday for PW Torch and on the WWE side of things, Survivor Series next week. Very busy
awesome.
November.
I know, it is. Looking forward to both shows. Brandon, thank you. Thanks to our listeners, and thanks to David Bryant, our Hits and Misses columnist. And we will talk to you all next time. And if you're looking for a full preview of all the matches that AEW oddly didn't talk about much at all, if at all, check out the flagship edition with Jason Powell from yesterday on our Blue Logo show, Search Wade Keller. We spent a good bit of time running down all the matches, including discussing Adam Copeland and Sting and Darby in that match and how things are going with them. All right, we'll talk to y'all next time. Thank you, everybody.